Frank Herbert is science fiction. It had been printed and distributed by B. Dalton Bookseller and used for promotion of his books. He said the Dune movie looked like a go once more in its long and checkered history. Dino De Laurentiis was talking about a $40 million production, including a $10 million cost overrun guarantee from Universal Studios. Dad said, with luck, the movie might be completed in a year and a half, but added quickly that he would be surprised if it happened that soon. "I'll believe it when I'm sitting in the theater with a box of popcorn," he quipped. My father and his longtime best friend, Howie, talked a lot about old times, and in the process told a number of great stories, some of which I had heard previously. Howie told some amusing jokes from the 1950s. Howie also said that when he heard his buddy was going to be on Seattle's KIRO radio that morning, he called the show's producer and asked him to be certain that the moderator, Jim French, didn't ask the usual stupid questions my father had faced on other programs. "This man has something important to say," Howie said. "Ask him something intelligent." He went on to tell the producer that Frank Herbert was a member of a writing team when he created his great novels. "My mother," Howie said, "was the other member of that team." "Tell French to ask about Bev," Howie said. And French did exactly that, eliciting an emotion-filled expression of gratitude from Dad for her contributions to his life and career. When Dad felt it was time to leave the dinner table, he rose first, and the rest of us followed. I had seen this interesting phenomenon in my business career as well, the boss rising first and the rest following, the dominant person who knew he was in control. On the way back to the room, I walked with Dad and noticed, for the first time, that he always walked half a shoulder ahead, never content to relax and fall in beside or behind another person. He was a man with an incredible energy source, a dynamo. I realized, as I got to know my father, that he wanted it all. He wanted strong family ties, and he tried hard in that direction. But he wanted celebrity status, too, which left him less time to be with his family. Ironically, he had become a hero to millions of readers, despite his professed aversion to heroes, a key point of his most famous series of books. If he was ever asked whether he considered himself a guru, he invariably quipped that he was planning to open Herbertville in Guyana to house the inner circle of his cult, and he needed someone to handle the Kool-Aid concession for him. Or he might say, with disarming humility, "I'm nobody." The following morning, Mom and Dad caught a plane to Hawaii, where they checked on the progress of construction. After that, they flew on to Australia, where Dad was guest of honor at a big science fiction convention. From Australia, Mom sent postcards to Julie and Kim with pictures of baby kangaroos in the pouches of their mothers. They flew to Singapore, where they stayed at the famous Raffles Hotel, but for only one night. "The service has gone to pot," Dad told me later. A new Raffles Convention Center was being built near the hotel, and they felt the area was becoming too tourist-oriented. They found another hotel. Then on to Zurich, where they stayed in a second-floor suite in the elegant Dolder Grand Hotel. After that, they spent a couple of days in Scotland, touring castles, and a week in Ireland, where Dad researched the setting of his new novel, The White Plague. He had contracted with Putnam to write this book under a package arrangement with God Emperor of Dune. In Ireland, he obtained maps, coastline charts, and other documents, and took hundreds of photographs, tracing the entire path he had in mind for characters in his book. "When we were in Ireland," Mom would report to me later, "I saw you everywhere." This was in reference to my facial features, which she said were very Irish. Ireland was followed by London, where Dad called upon his favorite tailor, Anderson and Shepherd, from whom he ordered a suit. He and Mom then took a one-day side trip to Birmingham for an autograph party, where hundreds of English fans queued around the block to purchase his books and obtain autographs. Early in July, I completed Sidney's Comet and mailed it to an agent in New York City. His name was Clyde Taylor, and he had been recommended by my father after I'd experienced difficulty finding an agent. Following Dad's advice, I set immediately to work on another novel, a sequel about a magical universe in which comets were sentient life forms. My new novel, The Garbage Chronicles, would resume the satirical ecology theme from Sidney's Comet, about garbage catapulted into deep space. Chapter 29. Some Things My Father Did Well. In the summer of 1981, Frank Herbert received the biggest science fiction book contract in history for Heretics of Dune, Dune 5. Part of the deal was a high-limit accident insurance policy to be paid for by the publisher. To reduce income taxes, he was receiving the funds over several years. Mom kept saying she couldn't believe the size of the contract, but there was good reason for it. God Emperor of Dune was a phenomenal bestseller, and the sales of the entire Dune series, now at 4 books, were exploding. A full-page Washington Post article ran that year about the tremendous success of God Emperor. Putnam's hardcover edition of the book had a sphinx on the cover, but in the newspaper article, the artist drew Frank Herbert's bearded face on the sphinx. Soon Dad's literary agent was in London negotiating for the book rights to Dune 6, as yet untitled. Dad expected to receive more than twice as much for it as he had received for Heretics. During the next writing session with my father at Xanadu, I saw maps of Ireland displayed in the study, and Dad showed me several slides of Dublin and of the completed Kawaloa caretaker's house. His upcoming novel based in Ireland, The White Plague, would begin with a man's family being killed by a bomb explosion in Dublin. On the maps, Dad showed me the path of the story in detail, across the Republic of Ireland. He pointed out a place they visited in County Clare on the west coast, Spanish Point, where a large portion of Philip II's Spanish Armada ended up on the rocks in September 1588. He also showed me a burgee from the Royal Cork Yacht Club in Ireland that he intended to fly on his own sailboat. It was a triangular red banner with a harp, maiden, and a crown on it, based upon the burgee design of the first yacht club in the world, established there in 1720. Dad and I played hearts that evening, and he beat me soundly. The next morning, Sunday, he was preparing hot chocolate and toast for us, with Hawaiian guava jelly, and I said to him in a mock pitiful tone, "You didn't have to win every game of cards, did you? Couldn't you have lost just one to make me feel better?" He smiled impishly and replied, "There are some things I don't do well." When we left to return home, Dad gave me a ballpoint pen on a leather neck strap, a pen that he had used for autograph parties. I liked the gift very much, not only for its utility, but for its symbolism. The writing instrument clicked in and out of a clip on a necklace that remained around the neck. He said he had a number of them in a variety of colors, purchased at a stationery store in London. I was busy with my writing during this time. In addition to the novel, I was collaborating with an elderly friend, Walt Green. We were putting together a collection of aphorisms that had grown quickly to 5 books. A number of local stores were carrying my classic comebacks book, which buoyed my spirits, and Jen helped even more by asking other stores to order the book. In mid-July, I learned that Mom had been coughing a little. She said it had begun some weeks before, after touring a damp and drafty Scottish castle. It was nothing, she assured us, and had been improved with medication prescribed by a Port Townsend doctor. But on July 27th, Dad called from Port Townsend and said, in an unsteady voice, that Mom had been diagnosed by a local doctor as having pericarditis, meaning the pericardium, the membranous sac containing her heart, had been filling with fluid, placing a strain on the heart. She was tiring easily and was short of breath. Her lungs were congested. Dad said he would be taking her into Group Health Hospital in Redmond in 2 days. He assured me that it was a correctable condition and that the recovery period on pericarditis was dramatic. "The prognosis is good for a full recovery," he said. Still, I heard the strain in his voice. The following day, Mom telephoned Jan and expressed concern that now she wouldn't feel well enough to help with our baby, which was due in October or November. There had been plans for my 13-year-old daughter Julie to stay in Port Townsend that summer as well, and now they would have to be canceled. Mom had been knitting a tiny white sweater for the baby, and doubted if she would have the energy to complete it. On her first day in the hospital, Mom looked good, and told us she was feeling better than the night before, when she had been congested. I sat by the bed and held her hand for a moment. Her hand was warm, and she squeezed mine reassuringly. In ensuing days, I took a bag lunch and ate with her in a room, while she complained about the steamed hospital fare and picked at it. One day, I brought along a file folder of cartoons from my office funny files, since Mom so enjoyed ones I had mailed to her in the past. Sometimes Jan and I brought her treats for her sweet tooth, such as a fluffy raspberry mousse in a glass dish. On other occasions, we brought her balloons and boxes of Frango mints, her favorite chocolate candy, and a chocolate milkshake. Mom drank the milkshake too quickly, and it caused a coughing spell that worried us. Maybe it was the temperature of the drink, or the milk. Dad sent the nurse to get Cepacol throat lozenges, but the coughing subsided before the lozenges arrived. Mom was sent by Cabulance to Seattle for tests at another facility, and then back to Redmond. After 3 days, she was released from the hospital, but would have to return the following week for pericardial surgery, at which time the surgeons would open the chest cavity and determine whether portions of the pericardium needed to be removed. Back in 1974, Mom had received 4,000 rads of radiation to her left lung without shielding of the heart. The treatment had been administered through a single anterior port, according to the best technology of the day. Subsequent studies determined, however, that patients undergoing such a procedure had a high chance of sustaining damage to the pericardium, such as pericardial effusion, the leaking of fluids into a body cavity. It would have been safer to have administered lower doses of radiation through multiple anterior and posterior ports, with shielding of the heart. On Sunday, August 9, 1981, Dad checked Mom into Group Health Hospital in Redmond. She seemed to be much better, and we were told that the doctors planned to operate Monday or Tuesday. But late that afternoon, her condition worsened. She was diagnosed with cardiac tamponade, a condition in which her heart was compressed due to an accumulation of fluids in the pericardium. Doctors were using pericardiocentesis to remove the excess fluids and stabilize her. We soon learned that she would need to have most of her pericardium removed surgically at University Hospital in Seattle, where they could give her more specialized heart treatment. She was taken to Seattle and placed in a critical care unit. 2 days later, Mom underwent surgery. They removed approximately two-thirds of her pericardium in what was called a pericardectomy. I did not learn until later that she experienced cardiopulmonary arrest just as she was being transferred from the operating room. Her trauma involved an excessively rapid heartbeat and uncontrolled twitching and quivering of the heart ventricles with low blood pressure. Medical personnel administered nearly 20 minutes of CPR on her with the aid of drugs, and finally her vital signs improved. She was in a glassed-in room, and over the next couple of days, Jan and I were not permitted inside. We could only look in while she slept for much of the time. It was difficult for me to write anything about it. I scrawled some rough, often unintelligible notes on scraps of paper. We brought her cheerful balloons and a big pink rose. Mom had catheter tubes in her upper chest to drain fluids that might remain after the surgery. She was uncomfortable from the tubes, but reportedly was recovering well. She looked weak and thin, and had a tender, wan smile as she gazed at us. When we were finally able to squeeze her hand, she squeezed back feebly, but there wasn't much said. It wasn't a time for words. It was a time for prayers. During most of the period that Mom was hospitalized, Dad stayed with us.
He slept in the carriage house over our garage on a Japanese futon.
I recall seeing him in our bathroom in boxer shorts one morning, flossing his teeth. He had always taken care of his teeth. They were perfect, without a cavity. He said he didn't sleep well the night before, and that when he drifted off he snored more than usual, and it kept waking him up. His back was bothering him a little too, though he propped a big pillow under the head of the mattress as he normally did. We offered him some aspirin for the pain, but he said he was all right. Most mornings, by the time I got up, Dad had already gone to the hospital. Sometimes he was so tired when he got home that he climbed the separate stairway to the carriage house and went directly to bed. On other days, he insisted upon cooking a gourmet meal for us. He even bought cooking utensils and left them for us, since he didn't like to cook with our comparatively primitive equipment. One evening when we arrived home, we found a note from Dad. He had misplaced his key to our house, but got in by climbing through an unlocked laundry room window. He did his laundry and ours, and then returned to the hospital. The note said he would make dinner for all of us when he returned. Dad spent entire days in the hospital with Mom, except for errands, such as an hour and a half to get a haircut. One day he had to return to Xanadu for things they had forgotten, clothes, books, and other articles that Mom wanted. It was no small task going back and forth to Port Townsend, with the main bridge being out of commission. But when it came to doing things for my mother, Dad knew no bounds. In her hospital room they talked, read, and played the two-hand version of Hearts that they had made up during their honeymoon. It seemed fitting to me that these people who loved one another so fiercely played a game called Hearts, and a special version of it no one else in the world knew. When we visited Mom one evening, Dad was seated in his usual place beside her bed, eating cha shu bao, steamed Cantonese barbecued pork that he had picked up at a delicatessen near the hospital and heated in the nursing station's microwave. Another day, when he went to a friend's house for dinner, he called the hospital every hour to check on Mom. Some nights he stayed with her in her room, sleeping in the chair by her bed. It was exhausting for him, and he wasn't able to write at all. Late one evening, Dad returned to our house with a Dune movie treatment under his arm. He said it arrived that morning, delivered to him at the hospital. It had been written by director and screenplay writer David Lynch. He was a third of the way through it, and I asked him his reaction. He made a circular perfect sign with his fingers and said, "Beautiful. They've got it toned into shape and are saving the original." By the middle of August, Mom looked considerably stronger. She smiled a lot and said she was looking forward to returning home and was worried about whether a pretty red-breasted nuthatch would ever return to the bird feeder outside her office window. It had been coming by for weeks and had been a delight for her to watch. Now, with no seed in the feeder, it might not. She was so much better and receiving such excellent care that Dad told us not to worry and that we should go ahead and take a short trip out of town we had been planning. In our absence, he stayed in our home, where he entertained David Lynch and a team of Hollywood writers, all working on the Dune movie script. They played volleyball in our backyard and created quite a stir among neighborhood children, who somehow got the idea that Lynch was George Lucas. Soon Mom was released from the hospital, and she continued to improve. Within a month, it was as doctors had hoped, and her tests showed rapid recovery from pericardial surgery, with improving checkups every week. Still, the doctor told her he wanted her to be more active. She was getting tired too easily. We had dinner with my parents at a Seattle restaurant, and my mother had to ask the hostess to slow down as she led us to our table. That evening, Mom and Dad stayed in a nearby hotel where we visited them. She sat on the bed with pillows propped behind her and a blanket over her lap, knitting a little white baby sweater. She said she really messed it up in the hospital while on medication, and now she was redoing much of it. Jan was due to deliver in 2 months. When we were leaving, I commented to Dad, "Congratulations on your book contract, and on the most important thing of all, Mom." "Doesn't she look great?" Dad said, looking at her as she sat on the bed with her knitting. And she did look better to me, with good color in her face. She smiled at me in a gentle way. As we drove home, however, Jan and I agreed that Mom was acting as if she were on heavy medication, a little foggy and forgetful, somewhat like an old person, breaking off in mid-sentence to speak about silly matters and not always returning to her original thought. We thought she might still be depressed. It was her second major health crisis. We fell silent as we crossed the old Mercer Island floating bridge that spanned Lake Washington, with the lights of oncoming cars and houses along the shoreline ahead. Lately, I had been having second thoughts about the Boswell role in which I had placed myself, chronicling the life of Frank Herbert and the people around him. It hadn't started out that way in September 1978, a halcyon time when I only jotted brief notes on the backs of wine labels. By 1980, however, the information-gathering process had grown out of control, to the point where I was obsessed with a full-fledged journal. Gradually, the journal became a looking-glass into the goodness of my father, which far and away was his most significant character trait. The things he did for my mother in her hours of need were beyond anything I could have imagined him capable of. Day after day he sat with her in hospital rooms, lifting her spirits, telling her he loved her, obtaining anything she needed or wanted. But it was excruciatingly difficult for me to write about the sufferings of my mother, and this had become a terrible weight upon my mind. I was more than a man writing in a journal. These were people I loved, my own flesh and blood. I wasn't just a reporter. I was a participant, drawn like those around me along a powerful, uncontrollable current, not knowing what lay ahead. Another week passed, and during a telephone conversation with my father, he said he was in the midst of a lot of tax work that Mom was too tired to do. She hadn't been eating well, didn't seem to have much of an appetite, and was suffering from nausea and indigestion. Some of the medicines she had been taking, particularly the systemic diuretic Lasix, seemed to disagree with her, and he was talking with the doctors to get the medications adjusted. In the meantime, she was refusing to take the Lasix. Dad wanted to get up to his study and work on his book, The White Plague, but couldn't. On October 2, 1981, while I was at work in my insurance office, my agent Clyde Taylor called from New York City to say that Berkeley Books had made an offer to publish Sidney's Comet, including the payment of a modest advance. I called Jan first, but she already knew from talking with Clyde. "Great, honey," she said. I had Mom and Dad on the phone seconds later, congratulating me. He was in his study, back at work on the White Plague, while she was at the phone in the greenhouse. Mom had been taking a new combination of medication, making her feel much better. Still, whenever we got together to share a meal, Mom said she couldn't entirely enjoy it yet, as something funny had been happening with her sense of taste, something to do with her continuing recovery from the heart operation. Her breathing and cardiovascular strength were improving to the point where she could swim 2.5 lengths of the swimming pool now, around 35 meters, before Dad had to jump in and help her. She could also climb 2 flights of stairs at a time, whereas before surgery she'd have to rest after each half flight. So she was improving. But she lamented times only a few years before when she could swim 40 lengths nonstop. Mom looked good, but complained of bothersome itches from the surgery. A fine toast was raised to my novel sale, and more toasts followed, to Mom's improving health, to my parents' birthdays coming up that month, and to Dad's tremendous success. After we toasted Mom's health, Dad put his arm around her and with a sweet smile said, "I don't know why I love this woman so much." She nuzzled against his chest. Finally, the Dune movie was underway. David Lynch had created a fine screenplay, in Dad's opinion, very close to the novel. Lynch and the film producers were thinking of filming the desert scenes in Mexico's Sonora Desert, a picturesque region that would have the added benefit of cost-effectiveness from the devalued Mexican peso. They were talking with, of all people, George Lucas to do the special effects. This bit of irony was of some concern to my father, considering alleged borrowings in Star Wars from Dune, but he decided to stay out of the matter. From various projects, Dad was scheduled to receive an astronomical sum of money in the next 90 days, a much-needed infusion of cash to pay the contractors in Hawaii and Mom's medical expenses, which were not all covered by insurance. Mom said he was often writing before dawn on his Irish story, The White Plague. He hadn't started until mid-August, and now, less than 2 months later, he was already on page 233. Before beginning the book, extensive DNA research had been required, since Dad had in mind a story about a DNA experiment gone bad, in which a dangerous virus was released into the populace. He read as many books as he could get his hands on about recombinant DNA, spoke with scientists and doctors, and went a step beyond, to see how easy it might be for an unbalanced, dangerous person to obtain the ingredients and materials necessary for recombinant DNA research. He impersonated a doctor and telephoned medical suppliers. "This is Dr. Herbert," Dad said. "What does my purchasing department need to do to obtain boxes of XR27 and enzyme applicators?" Because of the potential for misuse of such items, Dad expected to encounter difficulty. Instead, to his amazement, he was told that he only had to send in a check for the proper amount. When the check cleared, the items would be shipped, no questions asked. He developed what he thought could be an actual deadly plague, and considered including details of it in the book. Mom and I told him we didn't think he should do that, since the wrong people might obtain the recipe. After consideration, he said he would follow our advice and only specify fragments of information. Too little for anyone to put together. Several days later, a friend of my father's told me, "Frank doesn't look well." I responded that I assumed Dad was just short of sleep. I dropped a humorous card in the mail to my father, telling him I loved him. 2 days later, Mom called me at work. She said Dad had been up since 3 a.m. typing, and he hadn't eaten a regular meal in all that time or said much to her. I repeated the friend's comment to her, and she insisted Dad was fine, just tired. He was on page 450 of The White Plague. He was trying to meet an October 31st deadline, only 3 days away, but it had been made nigh impossible because of the time he'd taken off for her illness. She said G.P. Putnam's Sons had already arranged for the book's publicity, and a special boxed edition of signed copies at $50 apiece had been promised, in addition to the regular printing. It was like a newspaper deadline for him, she said, a reminder of years he had spent working as a newsman while writing in his spare time. He was obsessed with meeting the deadline. They planned to leave for Hawaii on November 27th, waiting until after Thanksgiving so that we could spend the holiday together. I knew they were delaying departure for another reason as well. They wanted to meet the newest Herbert, due to emerge from a private world into a more populated one around November 13th. On Tuesday, November 3rd, Dad came out of his cocoon and phoned me. He was on page 491 out of a projected 550. Some of it was first draft, he said, but most was second. I marveled at his incredible pace. He could really put it in high gear when he wanted to. I told him I was having trouble getting going on my new novel, The Garbage Chronicles. I had a general plot in mind and some of the characterizations, but little more. He said not to bother too much with small details at this point, syntax and the like, that I should try to write through to the end of the story, even if it was sketchy, and then go back and fill in the details. I took his advice, and it helped speed my progress. While he usually did not discuss particulars of his works in progress, preferring to save his energy for writing, he said The White Plague was about a man whose wife and children have been killed in Ireland in a terrorist bomb attack. The man, a molecular biologist, decides to avenge himself by setting loose a terrible plague. After Dad selected the title for the book, he learned it had been used previously for a book in the 1930s about tuberculosis. It didn't matter, he said, since titles normally couldn't be copyrighted anyway. He spoke of his schedule. Later that month, on the day before Thanksgiving, he had a date at a recording studio in Seattle to read from God Emperor of Dune for a phonograph album being produced by Cadman Records. He also mentioned that around December 15th, he was going to meet Bill Ransom in Hawaii to begin their sequel to the Jesus Incident. The collaboration was expected to take 3 or 4 months. The following week, I called him regarding our upcoming Thanksgiving dinner, saying I had made reservations at a nice restaurant. Great, he said, but he went on to say he was having trouble with his Kawaloa house plans. He had included a number of features to make the structure accessible to a heart patient, but the Maui Land Use and Codes Department was giving him trouble, citing non-conforming construction. They were making him jump through hoops, and he had to modify the plans to comply with their requirements. He was also obtaining a letter from a doctor concerning Mom's medical condition, which he would send to the planning department. On Thanksgiving morning, my parents and I accompanied Jan on an appointment with her doctor in Bellevue. The doctor wanted to examine her before he went away for the holiday, as she was 2 weeks past due and was getting rather large. While Jan was with the doctor, I sat in the waiting room with my parents. We thumbed through magazines without reading much and conversed in nervous tones, hoping the baby might miraculously be ready for delivery that day. Presently, a long-faced doctor came out with Jan. He told my parents he was afraid to face them, because he knew how badly they wanted to see the baby before leaving, but he had nothing encouraging to report. She was only dilated 2 centimeters, as she had been for a couple of weeks. It had been more than 9 years since the birth of Kim, and with only a hint of a smile, the doctor asked Jan if she had forgotten how to have babies. Mom and Dad were scheduled to board a plane to Hawaii the next morning. Due to the rash of Christmas flights to the islands, it was the last flight they could get on. Otherwise, they would have had to wait until January, and they had to get there before then to supervise house construction. A number of important job site decisions had to be made. They planned to return to Seattle in June, and perhaps for a short while in March to see the baby. Back at our house, we visited for a while before dinner. Mom had lost a lot of weight and couldn't seem to stay warm in the cold weather, no matter how much she wore. She kept on a heavy fur-lined coat indoors and sat by the wood stove in the family room. We also had the thermostat turned way up and a curtain drawn over a large sliding glass door behind the couch to retain heat and reduce drafts. The next day, Dad called from Hawaii to say they had arrived safely and that the main house was turning out better than expected. The walls and roof were up. The caretakers, a young couple, were living in the residence that had been built for them, so my parents were staying with a friend, Mary Moore, the mother of race car driver and ABC sportscaster Sam Posey. She owned an elegant waterfront home a mile down the road toward Hanatown and was providing my parents with what she called the stateroom for guests. Mom was happy and breathing easier in the warm air. But Dad still hadn't finished The White Plague. He was spending long hours on it. On Saturday, November 28, 1981, I worked on the Garbage Chronicles until 2 a.m. At 5:45 a.m., Jan woke me up, saying she was experiencing labor pains. Margot Beverly Herbert was born at 10:36 a.m. with no medication. 9 pounds, 6 ounces. In the past few days, we had decided on the French name Margot for a girl, in honor of my maternal grandmother, Marguerite, who went by the name of Margot. With my mother in mind, we selected the middle name of Beverly. Of course, Jan and I also had in mind the wonderful bottles of Margot wine that we had shared with my parents. Chapter 30. Kawaloa by the Sea. As Xanadu was my father's place, so Kawaloa was my mother's place. Entry in my journal. On New Year's Day, 1982, my mother telephoned from Hawaii. After static on the line cleared, she said she loved a packet of baby pictures we had sent to her, along with a bag that had the design of a green cat on it. "It's the most elegant cat I've ever seen," she said. "But can we give it to Mary Moore? She's been letting us stay with her for a month and a half without charging any rent. Bill Ransom is staying here, too." "Sure," I responded. She said she didn't want to hurt our feelings. "My solution? You give Mary the bag. Our gift to you is a month and a half's room and board in her house." Mom laughed. Dad came on the line. He said Bill Ransom had done a lot of the work on their sequel to the Jesus incident, and that it shouldn't be too difficult to finish. They didn't have a title for it yet. I needed my parents to sign several forms for their property and liability insurance, forms I had mailed to them some weeks before. But neither Dad nor Mom recalled seeing my request. "You have to imagine the confusion here," Dad said. "Your mother has a little office space in Mary Moore's house. There are papers all over hell. We've lost several pieces of mail." He asked me to send another copy of everything. I told him that a friend from Port Townsend called and wanted to know if they had received the smoked salmon she sent. "What salmon?" Dad asked. Mom said the house was almost finished. The ocean was blue and it was 82 degrees. "Ain't it hell?" she quipped. Dad planned to be in Seattle in April for a second big book tour on God Emperor of Dune, this time for Berkeley's paperback edition. My mother probably wouldn't accompany him, as it would still be too cold in the Pacific Northwest. The hardcover edition of God Emperor of Dune was still on national and international bestseller lists, where it had been firmly entrenched for most of the previous year. This was Mom's favorite story in the series, and apparently she was not alone in her feelings. Because of stronger-than-anticipated hardcover sales, the mass-market paperback would not be issued until 1983. Dad said they might be in England in a few months, where they were scheduled to begin filming Dune. The producers had decided against filming in Mexico's Sonora Desert, in favor of Tunisia in North Africa. The base of operations would be in London, with a number of sets built at Pinewood Studios near London, the same location favored by the previous Dune director, Ridley Scott. At Mary Moore's house, Bill Ransom worked alone on the sequel to the Jesus incident, while my father continued to struggle on The White Plague. Shortly after the first of the year, Dad gave the manuscript to Mom and Bill to read, since he valued both of their opinions. After reading it, the two readers discussed the book privately and agreed that it was too long, with excessive detail about the Irish countryside. At coffee, they worried about how to tell Dad. Finally, it was decided that Mom would do it. At the appointed time, Bill made himself scarce. Upon hearing the bad news from my mother, Dad stormed out of the house and asked Bill if he agreed. The answer was yes. Dad's shoulders slumped in disappointment as he realized they were right. He had been attempting to work through too many distractions, and in the process had lost the focus of his story. He set about a major rewrite. Later that month, Mom called with questions about her insurance policies. She had an agent in Hawaii handling matters over there, while I was taking care of their insurance in Washington State. She was confused about things that she'd always understood before, and this concerned me. I wondered if she was taking on too much for her condition, trying to keep up with the demands of Dad's very busy and often complex activities. They had moved into the new main house, where construction was still in progress. At Dad's request, Bill, a former fireman and CPR instructor, trained each of the workers in CPR for my mother's safety. Bill also made up emergency instruction cards for each of the men to carry with them at all times. As I spoke with my mother, I heard carpenters hammering and sawing in the background. She said she was gazing out at the aquamarine sea, with palm trees swaying in the wind on the lower portion of the property, and could hear the duet of Dad and Bill Ransom typing in the upstairs study. Already the salt air had destroyed 2 rental typewriters, and they'd rented 2 more. Dad's study was smaller than the one in Port Townsend, Mom said, but with a similar low-slanted ceiling. It had a skylight, and built-in bookcases lined the walls, with shelves even over the doorways. One doorway led to her office and out to an upper mezzanine that looked out on the main level of the house, while the other doorway led to a private bath. Mom said the weather had been nice, but a bit chilly at night. "What's your definition of chilly?" I asked. 69 degrees. The house my father designed for my mother in Hawaii had a number of nautical features. Its floors were of rare and expensive reddish-brown koa wood, known as Hawaiian mahogany. A beautiful and durable acacia variety native to Hawaii, it was the wood ancient islanders utilized to construct canoes. The kitchen pantry door had a bright brass ship's porthole with heavy glass. A pair of great split posts rose through the center of the home alongside the living room, like pilings by the seashore. A graceful spiral stairway led from the main level to the upper, and in every nook and cranny, as on a boat, storage compartments had been built. It was a graceful, serene home, and with wall louvers open all day, the air from trade winds circulated inside. This was a palace in paradise, built by an emperor for his empress. In this exotic locale there existed ancient legends and superstitions concerning a vengeful volcano goddess, Pele, and Menahunes, little fairy creatures who played tricks on people or became night marchers walking over rooftops in the darkness. Legend said that pieces of volcanic rock could not be removed from the islands, at the risk of incurring terrible bad fortune brought on by Pele, commonly referred to as Madam Pele. It was considered bad luck to sleep with your feet toward a doorway, as spirits could force you to walk away from your body. And geckos, little lizards that crawled along the ceilings and rafters, could not be killed except by accident. My mother learned about malevolent spirits and how best to remain in their good graces. In this and other ways, Kawaloa became a spiritual place for her where she could touch her inner being, as she had not done since she was a little girl, and fantasy creatures roamed through her mind. The sea calmed her, and she remembered the tranquilizing effect of water upon her when she was a child living in the Pacific Northwest. Whenever little Beverly became rambunctious, her mother frequently sent her into the bathroom to stand in front of a sink of water and splash in it, or to sit in a tub of water and let warm moisture soak into her pores. The new home was right for her, and comfortingly warm, so that she could breathe easily. She felt secure and unafraid within the protective envelope her husband had designed and built for her. Beverly and Frank became kama'aina here, accepted as natives by the local people. Back home, February 4th, 1982, was an off day. It was a Thursday, and at work I commented to people how I felt out of sync, but didn't know why. I was not able to write over the noon hour, even though the garbage chronicles had been going fairly well. I didn't feel like eating my bag lunch either, and worked on insurance straight through the hour. Gradually, I felt worse and worse as the day progressed. At low points, I considered packing everything up and moving my family to Hawaii. Mom had not sounded well the last time I talked with her. Maybe Jan and I could do some of the work that was burdening her. At 6 p.m., I was showering after jogging when Julie ran upstairs to tell me, "Grandpa's on the phone, from Hawaii." I threw on a jogging suit and ran downstairs, over a static-filled telephone line. Dad related bad news. Mom was in the hospital again, this time Kaiser Foundation Hospital in Honolulu. He was calling me from the nearby Ala Moana Hotel, room 1919. Mom had been feeling very tired lately, Following surgery the prior August, she had developed a number of symptoms, including distension of her jugular vein, increased abdominal girth, and liver congestion. A series of medical tests had been run, and her case had been discussed at a special cardiology session involving surgeons from Kaiser Hospital and the University of Hawaii. She had, among other conditions, paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea, which was an inability to sleep well at night, caused by shortness of breath when lying down. Doctors were working to remove fluid from her liver, and she would have to go on a strict low-salt diet that also involved water management and the use of diuretics to remove excess fluid from her system. He mentioned what I already knew, that she had heart muscle damage, but added a new and disturbing twist. Her diminished heart condition was not holding. She was suffering from degenerative heart disease, and if her life was to be saved, this condition had to be stabilized. They wanted to keep her weight down in order to take a load off her heart, so it wouldn't have to work so hard. She would have to follow a new routine. In addition to a low-salt and fluid management diet, for every 2 or 3 hours of activity for the rest of her life, she would need to rest an hour. She would weigh herself several times each day, and if she gained 2 pounds one day, she would have to lose it within 24 hours. I asked how long she could be expected to live, and Dad said the doctors were not giving estimates. She could live 5 or 10 years, Dad said, or she could go tomorrow. My father was exhausted and asked me to call Bruce and Penny, but to tell them not to call and not to rush over to Hawaii for a big deathbed scene. He said Mom was strictly against that, and so was he. Everything was under control, he assured me. He expected to be back at Kawalua with her by Tuesday. I told him my thoughts about Hawaii, that perhaps we should come now and help Mom with her work. He said we should wait a year, that Hana was not a metropolis and not a good place for kids. He liked the idea of us helping, but Mom didn't like to delegate it. He felt her work sustained her, gave her a reason for going on. Dad said it was difficult living in such a remote location for more than a month or two a year. In recent weeks, he had been considering replacing the Port Townsend base with one in San Diego or Santa Barbara, California, where the weather was warmer and Mom wouldn't feel such a pressing need for the warmth of Hawaii. Whatever she wanted, whatever she needed, he would be her Superman, obtaining it for her, comforting her. He would set his writing aside entirely if necessary, sacrificing his hard-earned career. Just as she had set aside her own creative writing efforts in the 1950s and 1960s and took jobs in retail advertising while he wrote. In effect, she had put him through writing school, loaning him the better part of her life. Now he was repaying the debt. "Please don't tell your mother I called," he said. "I don't want her to think I'm worried." And he concocted a subterfuge, asking me to say I had phoned Bill Ransom in Hana and learned about Dad being at the Ala Moana and about Mom being in the hospital. As we closed our conversation, my father asked me to fly to Hawaii in April while he was away on a book tour. I mentioned the possibility of Jan going instead, since Jan had become like a daughter to Mom. "That, or get some psychological help for your fear of flying," he said. I knew he hated leaving Mom, and I wondered if he would even make the book tour. I was nervous after the call. Despite being a couple of pounds heavy, I went in the kitchen and gorged myself on oatmeal raisin cookies until I felt an odd swooning sensation from excessive sugar. In my youth, I had felt certain extrasensory powers of my own. Little occurrences, nowhere near those experienced by my mother. Frequently, I sensed things about people, almost read their thoughts and concerns. And they were accurate readings, from indefinable sources. After meeting and talking with a person for only a short while, I picked up things about their nature, took readings on them, and understood their motivations. My ability came and went, but at times, its accuracy astounded me. I used to think my intermittent ESP was inherited from my mother, but after I was married it seemed to lapse, and I thought anything I had perceived in the past might have been coincidence. But now, as I considered the events of the day, a chill coursed my spine, and I shivered. Could my feelings of depression all day have been a sympathetic reaction? Did I sense my mother's anguish from thousands of miles away across the Pacific Ocean? I so hoped she would live to be at least 70. She was 55, and deserved time to enjoy Hawaii. When my parents returned to the Hana house, There were huge changes. Dad went into a tirade in the kitchen and ransacked the cupboards, throwing out every can and package of food that wasn't low in salt. "This is the enemy," Dad said angrily. "We've brought the enemy into our house." It saddened Bill Ransom, almost to tears, that my father felt betrayed by food, something he and my mother loved so much. Bill thought back to happier times in Port Townsend only a short while before, when they picked fresh vegetables and combined them with clams and oysters from nearby beaches to make elegant, simple meals. During this period, I made a number of calls to Hawaii, checking on Mom. Under the new regimen, her condition improved. She was a survivor, a fighter, and bounced back yet another time. And my father, ever her protector, continued to guard her so closely that he didn't allow her to ascend or descend stairs alone, not even when she was feeling better. In one conversation, she and I talked about Margot, Kim, and Julie, and she said she wished she had the opportunity to know them better. I said she was doing fine as their Nana, and told her how much Julie and Kim appreciated receiving postcards and notes from her whenever she traveled. She sounded pretty good, all things considered, and nothing was mentioned about her trip to the hospital in Honolulu. She said she was sitting on the couch with a pair of binoculars on her lap, looking for whales. "I saw two yesterday," she exclaimed happily. On a Sunday later in the month, Dad called, and as usual there was a moment of fuzzy static, followed by his voice. He said that the White Plague had finally been dispatched to New York after two rewrites, one of which was major, cutting more than 100 pages from the manuscript. The hardcover edition was due out in September, and a paperback would be published the following year. "This one will make waves," my father told me. "It's a real shocker." The book with Bill Ransom was also going well, and they would call it The Lazarus Effect. Dad told me he had been derailed from the work by the close attention he had to pay to Mom, and he still was not back on track. But Bill had been picking up the slack. Early in March, my father called very late at night to tell me that he and Mom were arriving in Seattle on March 26th, and she was going to Group Health Hospital on the 29th for the correction of a faulty heart valve. Unaware of this specific condition until now, I'd been laboring under a general picture of degenerative heart disease stemming from radiation treatment, without understanding much about the details. It was unclear why such a serious-sounding procedure could be delayed for a month, but I hoped it would help her. Dad asked me to make reservations at the Westin Hotel for the night of the 26th. He specified a warm room on a lower floor, deluxe. In the past, they had been in cold rooms on the upper floor of the tower, where the wind blows right through. 65 degrees was cold for Mom. Chapter 31. Brave Heart. On a windy Sunday in March 1982, Mom called to make certain we had requested a warm room at the Westin. Nervously, she spoke of her upcoming hospital appointments here. "I don't know what's going to happen when they look me over." The following Friday, Jan called my office to say my author's copies of incredible insurance claims had arrived. After work, I saw my 9-year-old daughter Kim on the front porch of our house, excitedly waving a copy of the book. I signed copies for my family, using the autograph pen on a leather cord that my father had given me. At 10:15 p.m., we picked up Mom and Dad at SeaTac Airport. To my shock, she was in a wheelchair with him pushing her. The chair had a high aluminum bar overhead, which must have been for intravenous fluids and other life support equipment, if they were needed. "Don't let the wheelchair frighten you," Mom said, smiling nervously. "I don't need it, really." They were bound for Port Townsend for the weekend, and Mom would go to the hospital in Seattle on Monday. She looked tan and cheerful, but too thin at 119 pounds on a 5'7" frame.
In a little over a month, she had lost 17 pounds on her new low-salt diet and had been feeling much more energetic. The weight loss reduced the workload on her heart and lungs.
But she looked startlingly older to me, far beyond her 55 years. The skin of her face had always been full and rather smooth, and now it was much looser, with many more wrinkles. Her doctor in Hawaii, Milton Howell, the attending physician for aviator Charles Lindbergh when Lindbergh died at Hana in 1974, had thought oxygen might be necessary during the flight, so Dad had wanted to bring his own aboard. He discovered this was a violation of FAA regulations, however, so for an extra charge, United Airlines provided the tank. Mom had sat in an area designated handicapped, with her feet over an oxygen tank. Fortunately, she did not need to use it. While Dad wheeled her to the elevator, I handed her a bouquet of red roses and a copy of my second book. Mom and Dad were seeing Margot, now almost 4 months old, for the first time, and we talked about the French spelling of her name. Mom enjoyed holding the baby, but only for a short while, since in her weakened condition a 16-pound chunker was too heavy. My father told of standing at the island in his kitchen and watching a humpback whale jump just offshore like a huge salmon. Whales did this to clear the barnacles off, and for other reasons. His manuscript of The White Plague had been well received by Putnam in New York City. Their editors had gone over it carefully, and it was, in my father's words, ready to go. I asked him how the Dune movie was going, and he looked a little blank, but said it was still on track as far as he knew. The next day, a Saturday, we arrived in Port Townsend around 7 p.m. It was 50 degrees, overcast. The bullfrogs in the pond below my parents' house were croaking loudly. "Quite a crop this year," Dad said. "How you doing, number one, son?" He patted me on the back. They were cooking a spaghetti dinner, with a big pot of outrageously good-smelling tomato sauce bubbling on the stove. After I kissed Mom on the soft skin of her cheek, she asked me to prepare one of my specialties, the garlic bread. As I worked, she said she had read incredible insurance claims the night before and thought it was much funnier than my first book. Dad opened a bottle of white wine, 1977 Gunlach Bundschuh Kleinberger, before dinner, and we sipped while talking in the living room. The south wall of the room looked bare, as the Dune paintings were still in storage. The three overhead skylights had been covered on the outside with styrofoam to reduce heat loss, and looking out at the pool building, I noticed some strips of tar paper had been torn from the roof, probably by wind. It was nice to be with them in Port Townsend again, but things were not the same. My father was suffering from jet lag, a recurring problem, and it would probably take him 2 days to recover. Dad had read a medical report to the effect that complex carbohydrates could reduce the effects of jet lag. For that reason, he and Mom invariably ate pasta after returning home from trips. He seemed more tired than Mom and looked haggard. As he was leaving the room for a moment, Mom called out something to him, but he kept walking. She explained what I already knew, that there were sounds in the upper ranges he could not hear, especially when tired. At dinner we had a rich red 1976 Hermitage with the pasta. Dad spoke of jongleurs, medieval entertainers who sang songs and told stories, traveling from castle to castle. Before the time of the Gutenberg Bible, when there were no efficient means of printing, people had to remember stories as they were passed down. Only the most essential elements of each tale continued. Mom complained about the cold a number of times, even though it must have been 80 degrees in the house. We closed all the drapes and kept turning the heat up. Everyone except my mother had their shoes and socks off, trying to cool down. Kim kept saying how hot it was, so I had to take her aside and tell her not to make Nana feel bad. Julie and Kim asked their grandfather for autographed books from the glass display case in the living room, so he presented each of them with a signed book. Direct Descent for Kim, and a Delray Gold Seal edition of Under Pressure for Julie. A large and impressive cardboard poster of the Delray book jacket was leaning against one living room wall. Looking at it, I pointed out how much larger Dad's name was printed than the title. "That's when I knew I had really made it," he said, beaming. Dad said there had been competition and minor friction between the Kawaloa caretaker and the supervising contractor, both of whom wanted to be, in my father's words, Frank Herbert's main man. Both men were doing excellent jobs, Dad said, and he expected things to smooth out. He ordered some corned beef for each of them that day, in equal amounts, and ordered it shipped back to Hawaii. Surrounding my father there had been other similar tensions, involving friends and even family. Such competitions, I learned, were not uncommon around famous people, including those around President Reagan and certain religious leaders. It occurred as well among the associates of Oscar Wilde, and led to personal animosities that simmered for years after his death. Typically, subordinates jockey for position and attempt to undermine the positions of competitors, real or perceived. In Dad's case, Much of it had to do with the force of his personality. He was extremely cordial with people he liked, to the point where each of them thought they were closest to him and found it difficult to believe anyone else could have any part of him that was comparable to what they had. On Sunday, March 28, 1982, I was the first to rise and jogged 4 miles. Shortly after I returned, Dad wandered out of the master bedroom in a striped blue and yellow caftan. With his long, neatly trimmed beard, he looked like a distinguished Muslim, or a guru, which he often told his friends he didn't want to be, though they tried to build him into one. He sat in one of 4 high wicker chairs at the kitchen counter with a cup of coffee. Still perspiring, I sat by him with a glass of water and a banana. Dad spoke of his love for snorkeling. He described many dog pools, tidal pools on Maui, next to jungle and deserted stretches of beach. If he didn't take a spear gun in the water, parrotfish, flatfish, and other sea creatures swam up to him and looked in his goggles. Since the Hawaiian fish had been hunted for centuries with spears and spear guns, Dad said they seemed to have developed an inbred fear of such weapons. He said the only danger in the dog pools was from moray eels, if he stuck his hand into a hole or stepped into one. "Wear flippers," he said with a smile. "Let 'em bite the hell out of your flipper." He said the eels fed on lobsters, so you could get bitten reaching into a hole for a lobster. If one of the lobster's antennae was pointing at you and the other was pointing back in the hole, you could bet a moray eel was in there. A lobster's antennae are covered with sensory hairs that detect food and enemies beyond what the eyes can see. He wanted to get a cat-rigged Cape Cod dory for sailing in Hawaii, with an inboard-outboard motor and a centerboard keel that raised and lowered to get in and out of shallow areas where the most interesting dog pools were. Too often the best places could only be reached from the land after traversing treacherous cliff trails. Such a spot was within walking distance of the house, toward Kaupo Village, away from Hanatown. Dad went up to his loft, and soon I heard the rhythmic pumping of his rowing machine. I thought of what he had told me that morning about Hawaii. He seemed to be adjusting well to life there. But was he really? For years he had been attracted by the tropics, and now, ironically, he'd been forced to go there by my mother's medical condition, leaving family and friends on the mainland, isolating himself from other science fiction writers he had known. I have never heard of a finer friend than my father. He loaned money to some, and even bailed an advertising artist out of jail in the middle of the night, where he had been taken for unpaid parking tickets. Dad provided advice about writing, edited his friends' manuscripts, and arranged for publishers to see their writings. One of the people he helped, Mom's friend Frankie Goodwin, said that he taught her to never use the word "very" in anything she wrote. If she ever had the urge to use it, he told her to substitute the word "damn" instead. He had many good friends with a variety of backgrounds. They included the merchant seaman Howie Hansen, the authors Jack Vance and Paul Anderson, the artist Bernard Zackheim, the photographer Johnny Bickle, and our companion in Mexico, Mike Cunningham. One of Dad's closest friends was Russ Ladd, a California Highway Department employee who introduced him to the Zen writings of Alan Watts. Another who had appeared in recent years was the poet and author Bill Ransom. There were many more. My mother's close female friends were equally numerous, and all were strong, intellectual women, as she was. Sadly, with all the changes in the lives of my parents, they lost track of some people over the years. The move to a distant tropical island put up one more barrier, and they would not see many of their dearest friends ever again. Still, in the Dune series, my father wrote of the importance of change and adaptation, and asserted that those who didn't do so grew stagnant. Frank Herbert was anything but stagnant. He decided to make the best out of the move to Hawaii, turning it into an adventure and filling his ever-curious mind with new, exciting information that one day would find its way into his stories. Early that afternoon, Dad and I were alone in the living room, and we talked about what it took for a marriage to work. He said it was a sharing experience, and that one party should be careful not to make all of the decisions, or the mate would stop growing and become dull in comparison. Or resentful. Even with his apparent dominance over Mom in many respects, she had her methods of persuasion, more subtle than his, less obvious. He didn't always dominate her. They had their niches. Mom managed to grow despite him, and had turned into a very interesting person in her own right. My father had become, to his credit, something of a benign dictator when it came to people he loved. Jack Vance called just before we left, and I spoke with him, his wife Norma, and Dad on an extension phone. Dad said he was going to do a fifth Dune book, and Jack quipped, "Did the publisher ask you to call it Rebecca of Sunnybrook Dune?" "No," Dad said, without missing a beat. "Gunga Dune." Jack congratulated Dad on his success. A few moments later, Mom came on the line and mentioned my three book sales. Jack congratulated me as well and spoke a little about his own career. A modest, self-effacing man, Jack didn't boast. But I knew he was a science fiction superstar in Europe, where people lined up for blocks to obtain his autograph. After the call, Mom said Dad was always telling publishers how excellent Jack's work was. Frank Herbert was like that about other writers, very generous with his compliments if he felt they were deserved. I never knew him to harbor any professional jealousy. He looked at me and said, "I've praised you in New York, too." On the drive home with Jan and the kids, we encountered rain mixed with snow. On the evening of the 6th of April, 1982, I received a telephone call. "This is Robert Heinlein," a deep, distinguished voice said. At first, I thought it was a practical joke, and I darn near made a flippant remark. I had several friends and a father who had been known to do such things. But it really was Heinlein, and he proceeded to ask how my mother was doing. I told the science fiction author that she seemed better, but that she was going in for tests the following day. He sounded formal but likable. I thanked him for showing concern. "Bev is a very special person," he said. He asked me to call and tell him how Mom was doing, and provided his unlisted telephone number. Heinlein also mentioned wanting to see Dad at the Science Fiction Writers of America convention later that month at the Claremont Hotel in Oakland. I told Heinlein that Mom and Dad were in Port Townsend, but he did not seem to want to bother them. "Oh, they're stateside now," he said. "I mean mainland, now that Hawaii's a state."
After the call, I put two and two together.
Heinlein was going through the back door to find out how my mother was doing. He'd had a falling out with my father, but still had feelings of affection for my parents. I picked up the distinct impression he was sad about what had happened to the friendship they once enjoyed. They had gotten into a heated argument over a controversial literary agent, with the Heinleins and Herberts taking opposite sides of the issue. The following day, Wednesday, was pleasant in the Pacific Northwest, with blue sky, few clouds, and temperatures in the low 50s. Late in the afternoon, I picked up my mother at Group Health Hospital in Redmond to take her to a family dinner engagement. She was in good spirits and said she felt pretty well, but she got a little winded going up a small hill in the parking lot. I helped her into the car, then gave her a large photograph of Margot. On the way to an elegant Japanese restaurant where we were to meet the others, I told her Robert Heinlein had called and his purpose. She mentioned how close they had been once, with pleasant visits to the Heinleins at their place in Santa Cruz, California. She said so many fans discovered where the Heinleins lived that they had to put a high wall around the property for privacy. At dinner that evening, Dad asked me to call Heinlein and pass along his regrets that he could not meet him at the Claremont Hotel because of a book tour that conflicted. I wondered aloud if my father shouldn't make the call so that Heinlein would not feel snubbed, but Dad insisted that I do it. He looked tired, and Mom said he had been doing a lot of her work. Bookkeeping, issuing checks, coordinating public appearances, promotional coordination, answering huge piles of mail, and the like. Soon my father turned his attention to Margot, who was being held by Jan on his immediate left. We were at a low table with our shoes off. He touched Margot's hand and began talking with her. For a moment, the four-month-old child stared at her grandfather wide-eyed. Then she let out a little squeal of displeasure. "It's probably Frank's beard," Mom said. "A lot of babies are afraid of beards." Later, as Margot was crawling around on the straw mat and Jan called her, my mother said, "It seems funny to hear the name Margot around the family after so long." More than 30 years had passed since the death of her mother, Marguerite, also known as Margot. We got to talking about hands, looking at one another's lifelines on our palms. Mom was an expert in the subject, said she used to read a lot of people's futures from looking at their hands. "But I was too good at it," she said, and had to give it up. She spoke of some frightening predictions of hers that had come to pass, all of which she had determined by sensing vibrations while holding another person's hand. In one case, she warned the person, a close female friend, of an impending accident and counseled extreme caution. A short time later, the woman was seriously injured in an automobile accident with severe brain damage. Dad said the filming of Dune was still scheduled for England, with the desert scenes slated for Tunisia. He was waiting to be called on location as the technical advisor. We drove my parents to the Westin Hotel in downtown Seattle. On the way, Mom talked about needing to have her gold wedding band cut down. It was too loose on her finger, from all the weight she had lost. Dad suggested that they find the same justice of the peace who had married them in Seattle in 1946. "Then I'll marry you again," he said. The following Thursday, my father flew off alone to start his second God Emperor of Dune book tour across the U.S. and Canada. Mom had to remain in Seattle for more medical tests and planned to leave the next day to join him. After the tests, she and Jan had lunch together at an East Indian restaurant in Seattle and went clothes shopping for Julie's 14th birthday. Because of Mom's limited energy, they had to take cabs on three occasions for short distances. At the restaurant, which was on the second floor of a building across the street from Pike Place Market, a farmer's market with fresh produce, Mom told Jan she had been given bad news by the doctor that morning, and she hadn't told Dad yet. Her heart function was disturbingly less than it had been on her previous test, and the doctor seemed unable to arrest her degenerative condition. Fighting back tears, Jan asked, "How bad is it?" "The doctor told me, you won't survive this one." Following a long pause, she added, "I'm afraid to tell Frank." Jan looked away at people bustling around the market. She regained her composure. "You can beat this, Bev," she said, gazing back across the table at the frail, impeccably dressed woman with her. "You have before, and you'll do it again." The doctor my mother had seen that morning said her heart had been strong or she wouldn't have survived so long, nearly 8 years after the diagnosis of terminal lung cancer. But, he went on to say, it was only a matter of time before her heart gave out on her altogether. He could not predict how long she might live. "I worry most about Frank," Mom said with a brave smile. "We've always been like one person. When I go, what will happen to him?" Chapter 32. I'll take your worries if you take mine. On the evening of April 17th, 1982, we met my parents at Trader Vic's restaurant in the Westin Hotel. My father was in the midst of a big book tour with another week to go. He had signed thousands of books in Toronto alone, so many that he'd been forced to wear a wrist brace. This was a custom appliance that wrapped tightly around his wrist and the heel of his hand, looping around the thumb. It kept the wrist straight and stable so that it didn't constantly flex with each signature he made, tiring it out. Even so, he said he could hardly move his right hand after the signings. A limousine met them in every city. "I'm not playing BTO, big-time operator," he said. "The limo is a matter of survival." In Philadelphia, the vehicle was a fabulous 1926 Rolls-Royce Landau with an open area for the driver. It had a cigar lighter in the back and little snippers on chains to cut off cigar tips. The driver was always using no parking zones and never got a ticket. They parked illegally and went to see the Liberty Bell. When they came out, a policeman was standing by the car. Dad thought, uh-oh, but the policeman was just admiring the car. For the Los Angeles segment, Dino De Laurentiis sent an immense private limousine to pick them up at the airport. The chauffeur gave Mrs. Herbert an exquisite red rose and served champagne in the car. Dad caught a cold in Texas and was still hacking from it. He had to take lozenges during many interviews. He also had a skin split on his right eyelid, and Mom had a sore on her upper lip, conditions from the dry, windy cold on the East Coast. They didn't talk about Mom's medical condition, and she looked much the same as the last time I had seen her, rather thin and drawn, but courageously cheerful. She wore a lovely Hawaiian shell necklace outside her blouse. Dad's beard was freshly trimmed, and he and Mom looked manicured. Dad was giggly and in a good mood, and he spoke cheerily of Mom walking off the plane this time, instead of being pushed in a wheelchair, as if she were doing better. This didn't track with what Jan had told me, and as I gazed into his eyes and into my mother's, I detected new sadness there. He was in denial, desperately looking for the slightest encouraging things, while overlooking the negative. Dad told us that the Dune movie director, David Lynch, wanted to leave theatergoers with the same feeling after seeing the movie as they would have after reading the novel. Lynch was going to extra efforts to remain true to the novel. We learned that their first caretakers in Hana, the young couple, were quitting to return to the mainland. They got island fever, Dad said. Couldn't take the confinement of the island.
New caretakers were on the job, Bart and Sheila Rast.
We all had quite a bit of wine and were getting pretty silly. Dad was telling some hilarious jokes when Mom touched his arm gently and asked, "Did you tell the one about the two Mexicans?" He then proceeded to tell the story and got it so fouled up that Mom interrupted him and said, "You've got it all wrong, you know. I hope you can get out of this." "Oh, I will," Dad said, with his eyes twinkling. "That's my business." A week later, Jan, Kim, and I met my parents at Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. They were just in from San Diego, last city on the book tour. Mom was standing straight as she walked and holding on to my father's arm. Weary, they took their car and drove straight to the ferry terminal in Seattle. On the first Friday in May, Mom cooked an entire dinner for us in Port Townsend, a delicious roast rack of lamb served with mint jelly, corn on the cob, and roasted potatoes. She said she was feeling a lot better, with her energy returning. She had been swimming laps of the pool in recent days, an essential part of her rehabilitation program. The water temperature was set at 91 degrees for her, which resulted in substantial electric bills. Margot sat on the living room floor atop a blanket while we ate. Looking down at her, Mom recalled how cute Julie and Kim had been as babies, and how Margot resembled them. Dad played a lot with the baby during the evening, pushing his beard in her face and making her giggle. That weekend, Dad, Jan, and I went sailing on the Caladan. It was a beautiful day, but a little too cool for my mother, so she stayed at home with the kids. Jan and I did really well, as the boat was easier to sail than the ones on which we took lessons. Standing at the helm, Dad said he determined wind direction by feeling it on his face, and that he had learned to do this as a boy. This seemed an extraordinary ability for anyone to have, and I was doubly impressed because he didn't have a heck of a lot of his face exposed around his beard. I thought of Paul Muad'Dib in a burnous on the desert planet Dune, with most of his face obscured by the tucks of the robe. Sniffing at the air, Paul could sense the approach of a storm, and could tell wind direction just as my father did. In ensuing weeks, my book, Incredible Insurance Claims, received quite a bit of publicity, and I was interviewed by radio stations in the United States and Canada. Dad said a number of people had seen notices of the upcoming publication of my first novel, Sydney's Comet, and they were